Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
This is Foghorn Leghorn, Bob Hill.
Foghorn Leghorn.
One of my favorite cartoons. You ever see that as a kid?
Absolutely.
Foghorn Leghorn, the sheriff.
That was a great one.
Of the chicken coop.
Of the chicken coop.
Yeah, he was something.
I don't have any leghorns, but Mary Quinn has some leghorns, and we're going to be talking to her a little bit later in the show. We're going to head out to Simpsonville, to Metzger's Country Store. It's my feed store, and it's where I ordered my chicks from, and Mary's going to meet us there to sort of give us a primer on what you do once you take your chicks home, you know, to make sure that they survive until you can let them out with the rest of the flock. So she'll be walking us through that. But before, we're going to talk to Rob O'Hara about what goes on prior to the little chicks arriving at Metzger's.
So how they get there, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. The chicken thing has kind of come full circle in my life a couple times. 30, 40 years ago, we raised them on our little farm acre and had a great eggs. You loved it. Mm-hmm. And then you read that eggs were good, eggs were bad. Now, eggs are good, provided they're raised properly and in the right kind of spirit with the right kind of food and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I think Mother Earth News has done some like testing and research. And they, you know, they test like the store-bought factory eggs with pasture-raised eggs. And they found that pasture-raised have, you know, higher levels of vitamin D and all the good stuff in the omega-3 fatty acids and this, that, and the other. And then they have lower amounts of, like, all the stuff that's not as desirable. So, and, you know, we've joked about it, too, just, like, the beauty of the eggs that I pass on eggs to Bob from time to time and just cracking them open and the way they stand and the color. There's something. And
they
do taste better. So it's a pretty fun and we believe it, I think. Don't you?
Oh,
don't
yeah.
You believe?
If I had to live and eat in a metal cage, I'd be a different animal, too.
Yeah, no kidding. My eggs wouldn't be so great.
I wouldn't be as happy either. So. Yeah. It works.
So we're gonna go all the way back to the beginning. Rob O'Hare's with Mount Healthy Hatchery, and it's in Cincinnati, Ohio, so not too far away. But, I mean, they hatch like millions and millions of chicks a year. And they don't just do chickens. They also do like pheasant and ducks and quail and other things. So we'll talk to him about that. But, you know, it is like what comes first, the chicken or the egg? And like, do they have like a yard out there where there's a roosters and chickens doing what they do? Or like, you know, I suspect it's done in a more
artificial
technological way. But that's a lot of eggs.
Plus, how do you name all the chicks?
No kidding.
I mean, a few million chicks a year.
Oh my God.
Abigail.
And just keep track of
Travis.
Them all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've only named two of my chicks so far.
Which are they?
Georgie got to name one of them Lillian.
There you go.
And that's sort of our little runt girl.
Yep.
I'll fill you in on some of the other stuff that's happened to her maybe next week.
Uh-oh.
No, but everybody's doing well. And then Ben Lovell, our neighbor, he came up with Clover for one of them. And she's got two, like some specific sort of markings where you can pick her out.
Four leaves?
Four leaves, exactly. She's going to be our lucky chick. So far we've got Lillian and Clover, and then Flo, who, that'll be with the story that I'll wait and tell you all next week.
Good.
She's our little nursemaid. So anyway, that's coming up on Homegrown. If you're interested in chickens, you definitely don't want to miss it. And if you're not interested in chickens, I bet you will be entertained nonetheless. How's that?
We do chickens well here.
We do chickens
at Homegrown.
Well. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Two very fragrant and underused plants, the Fothergillia and the clethra. I'm sure you've got both.
Yes.
Fothergillia I love because it's got these round, kind of licorice-smelling, whatever the word is, perfume things on them. I just love the plant. And clethra has kind of spikes, and most of them, a lot of them are pink these days. There's pink chimes, and there's other kinds of pinks. It's an easy-to-grow shrub, and you can smell the thing 5-10 feet away when it's in full bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fothergillia has beautiful leaf color in the fall, too.
It really does. And just nice leaf texture, really kind of, you know, robust.
So people that want something different, go look for Fothergillia or clethra in your garden and appreciate it. Put it next to you where you sit in the summer evening and enjoy the fragrance.
Yeah, sounds good.
How about the Wishy State? What's
up? Well, I'm planning and plotting a I'm anxious to get some of these warm season vegetable crops into the garden, but I just wanted to warn everybody, because, you know, I get sort of anal about my tomato plants.
Yes.
And come Derby time, people, you know, just before Derby and just after, they're so ready to get their tomato plants planted. But I just want to warn everybody that if the temperatures are still cool, particularly nighttime temperatures, hold off on putting your tomato plants out because they have noted in research that those cool evenings really sort of stunt them or hold them back.
Right.
And then later in the season, you're wondering why they're a little, you know, they're not blooming as well or they're not ripening as quickly or, you know what I mean? And it's often relates to putting them out too early when it's too cold. They like it warm.
Yeah, the soil temperature's not high enough, they're not going to grow anyway.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So you're wasting your time.
Exactly. And then the ambient air temperature, it's going to kind of stunt them or hold them back a little bit too. So just be patient, watch the weather, and wait until we, you know, have a more even sort of temperature outside.
So in human terms, kind of homeschool your tomatoes.
Exactly.
Until they're ready to get out there and go to kindergarten, first grade with the other kids.
There you go. Very well put. Very well put. All right. Nothing on the calendar that I know of.
There's a horse race coming up.
Exactly. Predominantly speaking. Because of Derby.
Yeah.
Most people don't schedule anything Derby weekend.
Trips to Destin, Florida.
Maybe that.
The locals, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They may get out of town, right. But nothing's going on. But we'll keep you posted as the rest of the month unfolds. And if you have a gardening-related event coming up, let us know. You can go to our website at wfpl.org and send us an email that way, and we can inform everybody else.
Or if you have a neighbor that has a really neat garden, we want to go out and meet people and talk to people and visit their gardens. If somebody you know has a really interesting garden or place or plant or anything, give us a call, and we may wander out there, mm-hmm. microphones in hand, mm-hmm. a producer in tow,
yep.
and do a great job of explaining it.
Yeah. And you know what, a lot of people I think are introducing chickens into their gardens, even city gardens. I think Louisville, you can have a couple of chickens in town, no roosters though, keep down the noise,
just on the metro council.
But it's interesting statistically, chicken sales are up. Yep. And Rob O'Hare's joining us now. He's from Mount Healthy Hatchery. He's the president of the hatchery. It's near Cincinnati, and apparently it's extremely difficult to place orders for chicks at this point because all the hatcheries around the country are having a hard time keeping up with the demand. So, as such, we wanted to look into the business. Mount Healthy's actually been in business since 1924, Bob, so that's, what, 85 years?
Yeah.
Today, the hatchery hatches out millions of chicks each year, and we'll, you know, find out if this year is, in fact, a record-breaking year for Rob and everyone there. Rob, I know you're busy, so an extra thanks for joining us today, and welcome to Homegrown.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Janine.
Great. Mount Healthy has been in business for 85 years, is that right?
That is correct.
So is this a family business for you, or how did you get involved in it all?
Well, yes, it's family. I'm third generation. My grandfather started back in 1924.
Uh-huh.
He died in 1969. My father took over. And just recently, over the last 5 years or so, you know, I've taken over. My dad retired.
Uh-huh. So did you grow up working in the business?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
When you start from the bottom.
In a family business, everybody works.
Yeah, sure. So, like, one question, just in terms of the span of the hatchery business. It used to be a long time ago, right? People would just raise chickens and they let their chickens hatch their own eggs. So when was it that, like, hatcheries came into business to begin with and sort of take care of that process and then sell the little chicks out?
Well, it's, I mean...
Was there something historical that sort of precipitated, you know,
a demand,
boom?
Uh-huh. You know, people, there was a demand that you just couldn't do, you couldn't satisfy the amounts of birds that people needed, that people didn't have the space.
Okay.
When you use incubation equipment, you can hatch a much larger amount than you know, the hens doing it, you know, the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did it work in the 1920s compared to now?
The equipment has changed dramatically. Right. I mean, they used to actually use gas-run incubators.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have, you know, a lot of the electronics and, of course, the computer equipment that we have these days.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, much more antiquated,
mm-hmm.
You know, much more labor-intensive than it is now. And then sanitation has changed over the years. They found out how important it is to keep things clean for the quality of chick that you get.
Mm-hmm.
Now, could they ship the chicks back then and people come and get them in those days?
Well, at first it started, people would come and get them, but as the post office, I mean, what we do is we're called a mail order hatchery, so we actually ship chicks right through the mail, right to local post offices where people can pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they've done that for years and years, but they used to do mostly by train. You know, now things have evolved, of course, you know, everything's trucked or flown to get, you know, the service much more quickly.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, give me like a snapshot, I guess, of what I would see kind of start to finish in terms of starting with just the process of fertilizing and having an egg that has a chick inside, right? To the little chicks that came to my door that were from Mount Healthy that are now living in my dining room.
I can kind of explain our process.
Yeah. I mean, there's not two chickens out in the yard doing what chickens do. How do you get the fertilized egg to begin with?
Well, I mean, there sort of is.
Oh, okay.
We have breeder buildings, okay? Each building holds about 5,000 birds.
Mm-hmm.
These are called, floor birds. That means they're not caged animals. They are actually on the floors, running free,
mm-hmm.
In a building, always contained for, disease reasons, so wild birds can't get to them. But it's the old-fashioned way where you have one rooster to every 12 hens, and they're mating, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what, obviously, if you put the right amount of males with females, you'll have fertile eggs.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is we go to our breeder farm, which is about 3 hours from our facility here. We'll go twice a week to pick up eggs, so we get good fresh eggs in our incubators.
Mm-hmm.
And the process is basically we bring the eggs into the facility. They're actually cased in 30 dozen cases. Those are transferred over into trays which fit our incubators. Each incubator holds about 50,000 eggs.
So does it look like a big kiln or something where you open, or a big oven, like you open it up, close the door, and then keep it at a certain temperature?
I guess you could describe it that way.
Okay.
It just looks like a big wall with doors in it with some electronic equipment on the front of it.
Okay.
They're called, these are walk-in incubators, so you actually have an aisle weight inside that you walk in. Mm-hmm.
Like a walk-in cooler, I guess.
Right, similar, yes. Temperatures are 99.5. Huh. We have spray nozzles, which make the moisture at 86%.
Huh.
Rob, I keep thinking of the horse breeding industry here a little bit. How long do the lucky roosters get to propagate the hens?
Well, they get to spend the better part of a year with the hens before new breeders go down.
Okay.
And what percent of success do you have? I'm sure you keep track somehow of the...
You mean as far as hatchability?
No, yeah, hatchability, and how many, do you get an egg per day from
Well, we get them up to about 90% production, which means, you're going to get, 9 eggs out of 10 hens.
Mm-hmm.
So. Right.
So how long does the whole process take? How long does the egg have to be in the incubator before it hatches?
21 days from start to finish on chicks, and ducks is 28.
Huh. So it's an exact science like that. You know that 21 days later, those eggs are going to hatch.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
How many chickens do you get a year then?
I mean, do we produce?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We'll produce, I believe, last year we did about 4 million. We are a seasonal business, so we actually shut down 3 months a year. This year, we're on schedule to do more, probably closer to 5.
So, wow. So that's chickens, ducks, quail, all the different poultry that you do, right?
Yes, yes.
Or
game birds,
turkeys,
things like that also, yes.
But the majority, obviously, are chickens.
Oh, yeah, the vast majority.
Okay.
Well, do you have any sense that your business is increasing because of the economy? People are raising more chickens? And we know that seed sales are up. Is that the reason eggs are up and chickens are up?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. The economy has sparked a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to be kind of going back to their roots and basically getting ready to take care of themselves a little bit. Chickens are a little easier type of bird to have. They're not labor intensive as some of the other animals would be. And, you get your eggs and you get a return for it all the time. You get eggs and then you have meat when you're done.
Mm-hmm. Most people want the hens, not the roosters. Is there a way to sex your little baby chick once it's born so you know what you're actually getting?
Oh, certainly. We have.
How do you do that?
Every hatch day, we hatch twice a week, and every hatch day we have 4 to 5 what they call sexers come in. And that's what their job is to do, is determine male and females.
And how do you do that?
Well, there are a few easy ways. There's certain breeds that are color sex, so you can tell, hens are white or hens are red.
Uh-huh.
Males are white. There's also what they call feather sexing. That's special breeding that you can look at the wing feathers and tell. But the vast majority, they have to do the old-fashioned way, which is vent sexing, which basically means they have to look at their sex organs, through their rear end.
Now, are they fed at all after they come out of the shells?
No, they're not. Mother Nature takes care of that. They have 72 hours from the time they're hatched. They live off the yolk of the egg. The last few hours before a hatch, that's absorbed into their abdomen, and that's their food source for up to 72 hours.
And then the eggshells go where?
Eggshells just go out to the local dump.
Okay.
So literally, when I picked up my chicks, they arrived at 10 o'clock that morning at the post office, and they were sent out and hatched the day before in Cincinnati at Mount Healthy Hatchery, right?
That is correct.
So they're hatched, sent in the mail, and then arrive, and I got them, you know, less than a day old, practically.
That's right. I mean, it's, many times they're even less than 24 hours old when you receive them.
Mm-hmm. Most of the breeds that you carry of chickens are non-meat breeds, right?
Well,
is that fair to say? I mean, how do you choose what breeds you're going to carry, you know, over another breed?
Well, I mean, really that's not true. Many of these are what you call dual-purpose birds.
Okay.
Okay, so they are quite good egg layers, but yet they're heavy breed birds where if at the end of the cycle you want to eat them, you still have a fairly large bird.
Okay.
Now, you know, over the years, the broiler chick, which is called the Cornish Rock Cross, has come along, and that's kind of replaced the meat industry because people don't, I mean, now people basically buy the dual-purpose birds more so for their production because they can buy Cornish and raise them out in half the amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
As the multi-breed, as the dual-purpose breed.
Okay, so that would be a good selection if you were interested in chickens for meat.
Absolutely. They grow out in 6 to 8 weeks.
And that's then they would be ready for slaughter?
They're ready for slaughter at that time, yeah.
Okay. So if, you know, for most people they're raising their hens for eggs, what's the average lifespan and, you know, laying capacity of a hen?
Well, I mean, lifespans are kind of all over the map. I mean, I was reading an article the other day. Lady had an 11-year-old hen.
Wow.
Very unusual.
Uh-huh.
But I would say an average lifespan for a hen is usually, you know, 4 years.
Okay.
Now, production-wise, she's useful for about 2.
Okay.
Second year, they'll be falling off already. Many people replace their birds every year because it just sometimes doesn't pay to hold, even though there's cost involved with getting the new birds, for the extra production you get for the young bird, it kind of pays for itself and then more.
Mm-hmm. What are the most popular breeds that you have?
Well, the production breeds are the most popular. Golden Comet is our biggest seller.
Huh.
That's a hybrid.
Okay.
And then there's, you know, old standbys like Rhode Island Reds and Barred Rocks. Those are quite good sellers and have kind of stood the test of time over the years.
Mm-hmm. Prices of a chick? Pretty reasonable, I think, like $2.50 ish, right?
Yeah, they can range anywhere from $1.50 to $3, you know, depending on, you know, what type, what sex, how many you buy, things like that.
And does that change from year to year? Has that been pretty stable?
Well, it's like anything else, you know, it goes up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
With all the costs involved, you know, every business has to raise their prices every year, so. You know, it's more than I'd like to charge, but that's what we have to do to be competitive in the market.
I don't know. It seems like really reasonable, especially since you get a good return of eggs after.
Oh, in the scheme of things, as far as animals go, yeah, they're very reasonable.
Absolutely.
Your bonding comes pretty cheap.
It does. I know.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible failure, Rob, because I had hopes last year of, you know, raising some meat chickens and, you know, learning how to process them, you know, just to experience it.
Sure.
Well, it ain't going to happen after having some Plymouth Rocks, you know, for a year now. I love them a little too much. And now that I've got baby chicks in my dining room, there's no going back.
Do they have names?
Two of them have names, and it's mostly because my niece named them. And then Lillian had to have a name because she was the one that they started picking on, and I separated her. But now she's back, and everything's okay. So she got a name just because we gave her extra special attention.
Yeah, I want a rooster named Bob, but it hasn't happened yet. Rob, do you allow tours of your place? It just sounds like a fun place to visit, just to watch the process.
Well, unfortunately, we can't do that. The state of Ohio won't allow us to do that for disease reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't have people, when you're producing this many birds, you just can't have people coming off of farms and walking through your facility.
Sure. So, Rob, what can't, you know, to that end, what can go wrong? I mean, you've got an... You know, the more you have, the more chances you have of having things go wrong. So what are the things you guys really need to watch for so you don't have a egg hatching failure?
Well, obviously we have to, you know, it all starts on a breeder farm. You know, we have to be sure that everything's being done correctly and sanitation is kept at, you know, a high level.
Mm-hmm.
In the hatchery itself, we have to be sure we keep everything what they call biosecure, and that means, you know, basically there's no outside sources coming into the hatchery. Nobody can walk through and, you know, maybe having something on their shoes or something that can carry disease into the hatchery. And then you're always watching for equipment failure. I mean, you know, these are machines that we're using, and things do go wrong from time to time, so they're monitored quite closely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have thousands of chickens hatching every day, I'm sure. I'm just imagine this room full of eggs with little beaks coming out the side. Is it just kind of fun to watch, or am I romanticizing this thing a little bit?
Well, actually, we hatch about 3 days a week. The other days, you have to prepare for the hatches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes time to clean up and transfer eggs. I mean, we use two different types of machines. There's large machines called setters, and that's where the eggs spend their first 18 days. Then the hatch are actually transferred into smaller machines for the last 3 days. And, you know, it's a process where you have to, after hatch, everything has to be pulled, dumped, cleaned, and all ready for the next hatch to be transferred.
So when they're hatching out, is somebody sitting there, you know, standing by, scooping them out, putting them in a box, like an assembly line sort of thing, or...
Something like that. I mean, okay. there's guys in front of doors all the time with tables, you know, counting them out. And we use plastic boxes to process them, and then they're transferred as orders are made up. They're transferred into cardboard boxes, and that's when they're going to go to the strapping machine and are shipped out all over the country.
Well, does the machine help them hatch, or is it on their own still for that process?
No, they're still on their own. The machine just keeps the environment. Chick still has to hatch on its own.
Pretty cool. So what's the worst thing that's ever happened to you?
Oh, well, I mean, we've lost birds before. I mean, if you have a power failure or, a fan motor fails on you when there's a lot of chicks on a machine, all the airflow stops, and that's when chicks suffocate. So unfortunately, you can have, equipment failure that causes loss of life. And you know.
Do you have backup generators?
We do, but the problem is you know, that's when a power outage happens, not when
something breaks down. Yeah,
right. So if you don't catch the fact that motor went out very quickly, you know, we our machines are alarmed, but still when there's equipment failure, sometimes the alarms don't sound off quite quick enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we keep people around 24 hours a day and watch them very closely.
Do you have any funny chick shipping stories where they went to the wrong place and this lady's got a box full of peeping chickens?
I've had plenty of them shipped to the wrong place.
Well, what's the funniest thing?
They were never intended for takes them home, but I don't think anybody found it funny. Especially the customer they were supposed to go to originally.
Yeah.
My box is peeping. My box is peeping.
Well, I'm awfully delighted by it all. You need to have some sort of, not that you need anything else to do this time of the year, but you need to have maybe a video tour of Mount Healthy on your website or something so people can see all the amazing stuff that goes on behind the scenes.
Well, actually, that's in the works.
All right, good. We'll be waiting for it. Thank you, Rob, so much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Rob O'Hare is the president of Mount Healthy Hatchery near Cincinnati, Ohio. Mount Healthy hatches millions of eggs each year, including chickens, ducks, turkeys, quail, guinea, and partridge. And of course, for more information on Mount Healthy Hatchery, go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we visit Metzger's Country Store in Simpsonville, Kentucky, where we find out what happens to the chicks after they arrive in the store.
You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. All right, welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill. We are on location at Metzger's Country Store in Simpsonville, Kentucky. What a great location. Right in front of us is a 5 or 6 rows of baby chicks peeping their little hearts out.
Indeed.
We've got dogs, we've got cats, we've got everything here.
I know. Metzger's not only sells chicks, they also sell the feed and all the paraphernalia that you need to raise them once they get older, but they also support the Woodstock Foundation, so they have pets here that you can adopt, dogs and cats as well. But we are here for the chicks today.
We are.
And joining us is Mary Quinn. Charlie Metzger hooked me up with Mary because she has experience raising chicks. Mary lives on a small farm, about 5 acres here in Simpsonville with her family. They raise chickens, they raise horses. Mary also does website design for horse farms around here. It is Simpsonville, after all, in Shelby County, so that makes sense. But Mary, we want to thank you for coming in and welcome you to Homegrown.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Chicks.
Yes.
We found out from the hatchery all the stuff that happens before we get the chicks. But
right.
Once the chicks arrive in the mail, and I heard you have worked at Metzger's in the past, and you have actually gone and picked them up from the post office. What's the experience like a box full of peeping things at the post office.
Well, it's funny because they'll call and say, your chicks are here. Can you come get them right away? Mm-hmm. So we rush down to the post office, which is about an eighth of a mile down the road. And as soon as you walk in, you hear all of these baby chicks in the back peeping, peeping, peeping. And you say, I'm here to pick up the chicks. And they're like, bring in this great big box of chicks. Uh-huh. Just put them in the car. Bring them over here. And they were hatched the night before. Uh-huh. So they're just, you know, just a few hours old.
Wow. So are they just jammed into
a box?
They
are just jammed into boxes with holes, of course, for them to breathe. But they are just jammed into boxes.
How many chicks to a box?
About 50.
Wow, it's my first apartment.
So do they, I mean, since there's different, like each box has one particular breed.
Or they, they may have a divider.
Okay. So it's clear who's who.
Yes, and they're clearly marked so we know what we're getting.
Okay.
Well, Mary, what got you into chickens in the first place?
Working here. And when these baby chicks came in and they were so cute and so cuddly and peeping away, and I thought, oh, I think I need some chicks. I have everything else, so why not some chicks?
All right, so I've taken my chicks home already as well. So I've had a few days to sort of adjust to what made me nervous.
Uh-huh.
What
they're still alive.
They're still alive, okay. And they're still healthy, but also, you know, things that I may need to watch out for. So for the novice,
yes,
chick raiser, yes, like myself, uh-huh, tell us exactly what you need to do in order to get your chicks through sort of those first, you know,
couple of weeks,
mm-hmm, as, you know, we take care of them as people and they don't really have a mama to be sitting on top of them and keeping them warm.
Right. I take my chicks home and I put them in a large, like a Tupperware container that's a storage container with on the bottom I have some newspaper and some shavings of some sort and food and water. And the food that I feed them the first probably 8 weeks is medicated. It's a chicken start and grow or something like that with medication in there for their immune system. Mm-hmm. And then water, of course. And they need to be kept warm because the mother chicken would normally have them under her wings. Mm-hmm. So we keep them warm with a heat lamp. Not too hot. If it's too hot, they'll be spread out in the box with their little wings spread out and they'll be panting. And if they're too cold, they're all huddled together, you know, trying to stay warm. Typically, you know, somebody will tell you about 95 degrees. I don't have a thermometer in there. I just watch them. And see how they do. Of course, they're in my house. They're in the mud room. Mm-hmm. They're not outside in the barn yet. So that makes a big difference. Okay. They're already in, you know, 70-degree temperatures. Uh-huh. It doesn't take much to heat that up.
Okay, but you could conceivably put them in the barn as long as you had it, protected from draft and that heat, that crucial heat lamp on them.
Right, right.
How quick do these things grow? We mentioned the chicks we're looking at here are only a couple days old. They're already putting in little tips of their wing feathers. When can you expect feedback and eggs?
Oh, well, the eggs will start in about, you know, we're getting them in the spring. They'll start in the fall, about October. These are 4 days old right now, and in about October, some of them will start laying eggs. Now, they'll grow leaps and bounds just every day. I keep them under heat for about 2 weeks, and then I keep them confined for about 8 weeks. And then I introduce them to the other girls, the big girls.
Okay, so confined, you mean like away?
In the small box with the heat lamp for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And then you can take them outside to the barn, but keep them away from the grown-up girls?
I actually still keep them in the house for about a month.
But just without the lamp?
Without the lamp. And then I start putting them out in the backyard for a few hours every day. Mm-hmm. And then as they get older, then I start taking them out to the barn.
They're just adorable creatures with just wonderfully poetic names like Araucana, Golden-Laced Wyandottes, Silver-Laced Wyandottes, Golden Comets, and Babcock, I'm sorry, White Leghorns. Talk about the different chickens and, you know, what each race or creed has here.
Well, I have four different breeds. I have the Araucanas, and they're very popular as pets because they lay pink, green, and blue eggs.
The Easter Bunny.
Easter eggs just already right there for you. So they're very popular. I also have the white Plymouth Rocks, which are kind of the old-time chickens, and they're very good layers and strong and hardy chickens. I've had the Buff Orpingtons before, and they were wonderful, marvelous pets, but they did not have much of a defense mechanism. They were taken out of the program quickly.
The first to go,
first to go. Yeah. I've ordered, and I have now, the new ones are the Golden Lace Wyandottes, and they should be beautiful chickens. And then I've also ordered the Golden Comets. I have those now, two of those. I think they'll be good layers, too.
Well, you mentioned some were taken out of the picture. Yours just, they're free-range chickens that go back into their coop at night. So whatever's out there in nature and likes chickens, that's the way it goes.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
But they're secure in their coop at night.
They're very secure in their coop at night. Every night at dusk, they go and put themselves to sleep, mm-hmm. and I go out there and close and lock the door and then open it up at about 7 o'clock in the morning, and mm-hmm. out they go again.
Mm-hmm. How many do you have total?
I have 4 of the older girls mm-hmm. and then 4 of the babies.
All right.
Baby chicks.
Okay, so good combination. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about some of the things, sort of troubleshooting with your chicks. If you do sort of notice some things, you know, going wrong, mm-hmm. you know, what are the potential things that could kill a baby chick?
Well, you want to pick healthy ones to begin with. And when you're looking at them, you want to make sure that their eyes are bright and clear and that they don't have any little signs of diarrhea or weakness or anything like that. But the chickens that are here, you know, they're pretty good chickens. So mm-hmm. As long as you keep them warm and keep them out of wind and they don't like to get wet, mm-hmm. if any of those things happen, then you get respiratory problems and digestive problems and things like that. You can bring them back, you know, I mean, not return them to the store, but you can bring them back to life and mm-hmm. health. Mm-hmm. It just takes a lot of effort to do that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was nervous about with one of my chicks, who does sort of seem like she's a little bit of a runt, but she's the sweetest one and we just adore her.
Picked on?
She's not getting picked on.
Good.
But I thought that she had maybe a little case of pasting, uh-huh. which on her little bottom, because her little bottom looked a little more inflamed uh-huh. and raw, and everybody else was fluffy. Is there something that I need to you know, pay attention to when it comes to pasting, and what is pasting?
Well, pasting is just, you know, a little digestive disorder because of, you know, a little infection or something that, like, maybe a little respiratory, whatever. And it's kind of like a little diarrhea kind of mixture where they get constipated with diarrhea, and then it gets stuck on the feathers there. It's not clean dropping coming out. And
she gets kind of plugged up then, I
guess.
Yes. Okay.
Warm water.
Okay. So give her a little bath.
Yes, a little warm water will do it.
I'll watch for sure.
Okay.
Because that could potentially kill her if she couldn't go potty.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Let's talk about the egg-laying cycle. Do they take January off? Do they take July off? How many eggs do you get from a chicken in a month or a year?
Well, my girls lay, the 4 girls that are laying right now, one of them's usually kind of the dominant one in the group, and she may not lay every day, but the other girls will lay an egg every day. As long as it's a nice, warm, sunny day, they're fine. And they'll go all the way through the winter, except for maybe January. They lighten up a little in January, and I may just get 1 out of the 4 every day or every other day, something like that. But as soon as the warm weather starts and the spring comes, they're good to go, and they're laying an egg. That little body makes an egg every single day.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is amazing.
So do you provide any artificial light to extend the, you know, those shorter winter days for your chickens to help
them produce
more?
I do. Now, some people don't agree with that you shouldn't do that. That's not natural. Mm-hmm. But I do. I have a light that comes on in the mornings during the winter about 6 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and just gives them an extra hour and a half of daylight.
And helps the egg
And it helps a little bit, yes, yeah. a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, they're free range in the summer. They're wandering around out there eating stuff and finding stuff. But in the winter, you got to provide most of the food, I assume. So talk about the cycle of feeding with the chickens.
Well, they have free choice chicken food, which is just the crumbles. And then I mix in the chicken scratch, which is the ground up, but not powdery, corn and seeds and things like that. So they have a mixture of that. And then
your hens are spoiled, because I've heard that chicken scratch is like candy.
Yes, it is, and they love it, and they'll come eat it right out of your hands. But you know, I also feed mine everything that we eat.
Yeah.
You know, if there's something left over from dinner, it goes out to the chickens. Same thing for breakfast and lunch. So they're eating spaghetti and chicken and scrambled eggs and whatever we eat, they eat.
I know you bond with these things. They're like pets, of course, but do you ever get one that's just an exceptional chicken you think is at least as smarter than you are, if not smarter?
Oh, yes. I think my one white chicken, who we have named Whitey, could be in the movies, because I have a big ledge outside my bedroom window, and in the summertime when the windows are open, Whitey will come and she'll jump up on the ledge, and we talk as I'm getting dressed in the morning, and she's waiting for me to come out and give her a little snack of some sort. I do have smart chickens. They're pretty good. good.
I'm convinced that they're way smarter than what most people think.
Including radio show people, yeah.
All right. So essentially, if we are going to raise chickens from the chick stage, heat's going to be important. Keep them in the house, or keep them under heat for 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
And then keep them in the house for another 2 weeks. Right. And then you can kind of gradually, sort of act like acclimating a plant outside in the spring of the year. Sounds not too terribly difficult, actually.
Not too difficult.
Yeah.
And you just hang on to them until nature takes its course. These are not going to be part of a meal at some point.
Oh, no. I mean, some people could do that, but I can't do that. Mm-hmm. No. They've become pets to us, and my kids love them.
So all of these girls that we're talking about clearly are girls. They're hens. Yes. Pullets are what, under a year? Hens are over a year.
Right.
Are there any roosters in your future? And do people even really need roosters?
Well, you don't need a rooster unless you want fertilized eggs and raise the baby chicks, you know, to hatch. Mm-hmm. I don't want that. I don't want any more babies. So we just have the eggs to eat. And so we don't need a rooster for that.
Mm-hmm. So if you do have a rooster, what can you expect from, you know, we've talked about our girls being sweet and smart and all that.
It's a whole different picture.
But what can you expect from a rooster?
I can handle this one, lady.
The rooster is trouble to me. You know, he causes too many problems, and I just don't need that. I don't want to listen to him, and I don't want to see all that nonsense. And I just don't need a rooster.
My wife says the same thing. I don't know.
I know that there's one advantage to roosters is that they can potentially protect the flock during the day because most of them have like spurs. So they'll
fly up with, you know, at you with those spurs out and attack you with the spurs.
Did you have any previous experience with chickens prior to this, just to encourage people who've never done it before that yes, it can be done?
I didn't have any experience, and it's not hard. You just have to have a little spot of land. Obviously, you know, if you live where you can, where you're allowed to do this and have chickens, it's really not difficult at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are you convinced, Bob?
Do you want some?
I've had them. I got enough on my plate right now, so to speak. Uh-huh. But I wouldn't say it's not going to happen at some point, because just being around these little girls here is just kind of cool.
Yes. It warms your heart.
It
I'd
does.
Have to
my
say.
Heart's pretty warm anyway.
I know. Mary, thank you so much.
You're
really appreciate
welcome.
Your
thank you.
Sharing your experiences with us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Metzger's, of course, is hosting us today. They're out in Simpsonville, Kentucky. You can buy chicks here, but you can also buy horse feed and straw and all kinds of stuff for your pets and farm animals. Mary Quinn, she lives here in Simpsonville as well. She raises chicks and horses and does web design for local horse farms. For more information, of course, you can go to our website at wfpl.org. And, of course, you can see pictures of the day there as well.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL, live from Metzger's Country Store in Greater Simpsonville, Kentucky. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
It must be spring because we're getting a lot of questions and some detailed questions. Maybe over our head in a couple of these, but we can give it a shot.
I think we can. This one's from Dean, Bob. He says he's looking to plant a medium-sized tree in his front yard, and he needs some ideas, including any specific varieties of dogwood or redbud. I hope he heard the Paul Capiello show, because there would have been some detail in there. He has a forest pansy redbud in the back, and he's pretty happy with that, except it seems like the bark's peeling off, and he's wondering if that's normal. And, you know, it's never good if the bark's peeling off a tree unless... It's an exfoliating species.
Yeah, but redbuds can do that a little bit, too. Mm-hmm. They're not the most totally stable of trees, but it depends on the extent, really.
Yeah.
If it's coming off in large sheets, you got a problem.
Yeah, never a good sign.
No.
A couple of ideas for some dogwoods and redbuds, and then also the second part of the question, Bob. He lost two pears in the storm last fall, so he's got some opportunity to start over in the yard. You know, he's got some perennials and low-growing shrubs and stuff, but he's interested in adding some small trees to that area. pretty good drainage, he says. It gets full sun. There's a little bit of a slope. The soil's in pretty fair condition, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So dogwoods, redbuds, and then any suggestions for other small trees?
Yeah, the redbuds, if he wants to stay in the exotic category, I like forest pansies. He's got that iridescent purple leaf.
That's what he already has.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Hearts of Gold was a nice one. It's got a yellow leaf to it. It's a really interesting looking plant. Next to a forest pansy, it's kind of a stunning combination.
Sure.
Appalachian Red is just a vivid pink.
I love that one.
It's a very, very bright reddish pink, mostly pink redbuds, really nice. On the dogwood side, there's Cherokee Brave, which is anthracnose resistant, and also Appalachian Spring, which is a University of Tennessee product.
We just got one of those.
Which is red. And those are both really disease resistant, both of them. Cherokee Brave on the pink side, Appalachian Spring is on the red side. For the smaller trees, I like a tree like Acer Triflorum. It's hard to find. It's a beautiful exfoliating bark tree. It's a maple, a three-leaf maple. It's just not used enough. It's a stunning bark.
Do they call that one the Trident maple?
Nope, that's a different one.
Different one,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, the Aristocrat Pear was. You want maybe a little tougher tree. I like hornbeams would probably do pretty well in there. They're a tough tree, though they take a little shade sometimes more than sun. What do you think for that area?
Gosh, I mean, since you want something small, like groupings of deciduous holly might be kind of cool. Service berries are nice for small. The Chinese fringe tree, the Chionanthus rotusus.
That's a nice one.
For small.
And then I like silver bells. I like snow bells. Mm-hmm. Both of those are really beautiful little trees with these just hundreds of white bells that hang down in late spring.
And they like a little shade, too, though, like in the afternoon. So it kind of depends on what that particular site is.
Yeah.
I like the hornbeam idea. I'd like to see people plant more hornbeams in our area. A nice, tough tree, you know, relatively small.
Not used enough.
Amermachia, but that one may be kind of hard to find.
Yeah,
but that's a nice small tree.
Yeah.
Tough, too. So, yeah, there's lots
of... That's a pretty good combination.
That's a pretty good combination.
But look for something different. Please try something different besides... Aristocrat pears.
Yeah.
There's enough of those out there. Bradford pears.
Yeah.
The world does not need any more of either.
No.
Say the truth.
No. But, you know, from time to time, we'll accept them. All right, Bob, how about this one? This one's from Melissa. Hey, you've sold this plant before, so you probably know.
Yeah.
My question is about my dabbled willows, Hakuro Nishiki. She has five of them in a row along the side of her house. It gets lots of rain and full sun in the morning. They're 3 years old, and each of the last three springs, the new growth came in white with peach tips, and that's what they're supposed to do. This year, they're all just green. So she's wondering why they don't have that amazing white and peach look anymore. To make things more intriguing, one of the five bushes I just put in last fall, they, too, are green. They all seem healthy and very vigorous, but she's wondering what happened to her variegated color.
Yeah, I've grown these for years, and I've had the same kind of problem, really. They're just not very... Willows are not very stable plants at all, and a lot of variegated plant trees are not very stable at all. Particularly these are probably just... They took rooted cuttings and stuck them. They're not grafted to something, so they're more prone maybe to reverting back to what they were supposed to be in the first place, green. It's hard to know. Sometimes my early growth is green, and then it'll turn variegated after that. I don't know how long these new growth is in her plant, so it's hard to tell. But by and large, it's just sort of the nature of the beast. These things just don't seem to last very long.
Yeah, variegation usually kind of shows up in a plant because of a virus. So that plant has to be, grown out and grown out and grown out to see if that actual variegation remains stable in the long run. And since this plant's been around for a while, Bob, and a lot of propagation's been going on, it just may have lost the virus, so to speak, so you're going to lose your variegation.
Yeah, they can get overbred and just overused eventually. But don't give up on it yet. Kind of watch it and see if that green doesn't turn to the variegation like you're hoping for.
Later in the season, yeah.
Because mine has done something like that.
Okay. All right, one more question.
Yeah, Doretta has a good question for us. Last year in mid-October, we cut down several trees in our yard. We ran into chipper the same day we cut those trees down and ended up with a big, beautiful pile of chipped wood that I planned to use around my bushes and flower beds as mulch. I put nothing on the mulch to help break it down or treat it for bugs, etc. My question, is it safe to use this mulch yet around my precious forsythia, butterfly bushes, lilacs, rhododendron, etc., without burning them up? It's been setting almost 6 months. Thank you for any help you can provide, Doretta.
Since it's been sitting there for 6 months, I say it's just about ready to be used. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
It should not burn anything. It should have already sort of broken down enough, you know, over the months. And, you know, I use wood chips as well in various places around the blueberries and in the vegetable garden, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's good. You should not have to worry about any sort of bug activity in there, I wouldn't think. No. I never have experienced anything. What you can do, Doretta, is if you feel like some of it is not broken down to your satisfaction, you can, you know, put a little compost underneath, you know, put the compost down and then put your chips on top. And then that'll sort of balance out any nitrogen needs that it has as it continues to break down. And of course, that'll be good for your plants as well. Particularly, I would do that with like rhododendrons and those more kind of shallow rooted plants, you know.
Now, would you put some acidic type stuff for the rhododendrons and your blueberries before you put this down?
Not necessarily. And, you know, unless you felt like you needed it, but not necessarily. I mean, I try to maintain that sort of
all along.
So just with healthy practices. But yeah, you can absolutely use it. And I think 6 months is a fair sitting period.
Yep. If you have a 6 month question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us this beautiful spring?
Speaking of beautiful spring, syringa.
Syringa,
lilacs. I love it. It's one of my favorite plants. They're just showing their blooms now. Of course, there's a billion different kinds and cultivars and sizes. But my first plant memory as a kid that really got me started, I think, thinking about plants all my life was the big lilac outside my grandma's house.
Yeah, I mean, and like, because you're northern state in Illinois, and Daddy would say the same thing because he was from Illinois. The lilacs there were so fabulous just because you held on to your winters longer instead of us having sort of most of ours burned back.
And we get the mildew here that we didn't get up north. And actually, this was in New Jersey where my grandma lived when I was a little one. But I was 4 or 5 years old. I went outside and looked at that bush. I thought it was 80 feet tall and I could smell it. And I can still see myself doing that. Mm-hmm. So I've always preferred the old-fashioned lilacs. I call them the grandma's lilacs because I just love those big old things. I've had many different ones over the years, the weeping lilac, the Juliana hers, which I really like. Another one called Sensation, which is kind of purple edged and white, which I love because when my dad died, a good friend gave us one in memory of my dad. Mm-hmm. You know how that goes.
Sure.
So when this thing blooms, my dad's back in the garden. I hate the name Syringa vulgaris. It's not fair.
But
it's common.
But it
I know.
Means,
it's common.
Yeah, it's common.
You're a Latin lady, but I don't like it's
but
nothing.
Syringa, too. Like, that's. Yeah. I'm curious.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Okay. There's also Syringa persica, which is the smaller Persian lilac. Mm-hmm. So that's better than vulgaris. And as I said, there's hundreds of cultivars and names. The name Syringa comes from the Greek word syrinx, means pipe.
Hmm.
Because their stem is very pithy.
Okay.
They used to make pipes out of them.
Huh.
Can you imagine that?
Hmm.
Or even flutes.
Hmm.
Also, our son named his cat Syrinx. So that's another reason I like the
thing. Like it too. Okay.
Yeah, and the common word for lilac comes from the Arabic word laylak, L-A-Y-L-A-K, or the Persian word nylak, N-Y-L-A-C, both which mean blue.
Okay.
It made its way to Europe from the native Balkans in Turkey in about the 1560s through church emissaries.
Mm-hmm.
Not botanists, but church people. Mm-hmm. Got to the colonies in the 1700s, were found in the families, of course, George Washington and Tom Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of great Americans had the lilac. It went from there directly to my grandma's house.
Sure.
And stayed there. A lot of myth and folklore with the lilac. In the old days, way back, they would mask the odor of the dead laying in state
with
lilacs.
Uh-huh.
If you died in April, anyway.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because it just depends. Huh?
And then as you drive around the country, you see patches of daffodils which are in old lilacs or old abandoned homesteads.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of sad like that. It's the state flower of New Hampshire because it's tough. It takes on the same kind of meaning as roses. White, chastity. Mm-hmm. Purple, the first expectation of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow, friendship. Mm-hmm. Reddish, more love. And it comes with a poem.
Excellent.
Oh, what a gift in the lilac flower, to send me back to the day and hour, to have me stand there as before, just outside my grandma's door. Perfume that will compress the ages, bringing back forgotten pages. So once again, myself I see, just as I think I used to be. Standing there, a little boy, looking up with childish joy at the transcendental power of the common purple lilac flower. That one's for Grandma.
That's very nice. Sweet, melancholy, yet.
Yep. That's all. Yet, that's what gardening does to you.
That is what gardening does to you. That's why we love it.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Next week on the show, Derby's just around the corner, so we're going to talk a little bit about mint and tomato days.
Homegrown is produced by the warm weather blooming Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.